Welcome to the Chasing Tomorrow podcast. This morning, I get the time to spend with Yoni Rosenblatt, who, as you guys will get to know, is not just a good thinker and a practitioner, but a podcaster himself and a connector in this sort of journey that we're all starting to head towards, where lifespan matters and longevity and vitality matters. Yoni lives this every day with his patients, in his business, which is growing and expanding, which is amazing, you know, the people you get to touch, but also his personal perspective on, you know, what is it that we can do individually to give ourselves the best chance to live our version of a high-performance life, which is what this is all about. Yoni, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Joe. I'm excited to dig in.
Yeah, and you're another East Coaster, I think, Philadelphia area maybe in the general.
Close. You know, you sound like a New Yorker, because if it's outside New York, it's all the same, right?
Exactly. So let's hear your story. Like, what's your origin story? Where did you grow up? What is it that you did both athletically and then how do you find yourself into PT over time?
Yeah. Well, born and raised in Baltimore, Maryland. I'm a fifth generation Baltimorean on one side. My dad's from the Bronx. So, you know, I grew up listening to stories of Moshlew Parkway. So I know a little bit, I know enough to be dangerous there, but Baltimore through and through. I went to University of Maryland College Park, go Terps, and just knew that I wanted to help people. And so I started saying, okay, I'll go into medicine. And I got through physics and I loved it. I was in love and I did really nicely. And then I got to chemistry and I was a disaster. And so I just started to realize like certain things click in my head and it's far more things that I can see, visualize and picture. I couldn't do that with chemistry, could definitely do that with physics, with more in the biomechanics side. I've always been a jock. I grew up playing three different sports at the high school level, then played a little bit of club baseball once I got to college. And so I started to fall into physical therapy and I said, you know, I'm going to work really hard at whatever it is I do for a living. I'm just like a workaholic. And so I wouldn't have time to help people outside of my profession. Mm. I figured my profession needs to be helping people make the world a better place. And so I went into physical therapy and I wanted to marry this altruistic idea of helping people and sports rehab. And very rapidly, I discovered that sports rehab has had a long way to go at that point to get to a high level. And I thought all physical therapy was sports and that they just helped athletes. And that is far from the case. Once I got to graduate school, I realized there's a lot more to physical therapy. There's neuroeducation and there's manual therapy, which I fell in love with for a while. And there's burn and there's cardiac. There's pediatrics. There's a whole bunch of stuff they try to teach you. And I'm like, where the hell's the sports? So much so that I almost, you know, exited stage left, fulfilled a bunch of stereotypes and went to law school. But I stayed the course and finished physical therapy. School started working for other people. And again, very rapidly realized I got tired of learning what not to do. And I wanted to learn what to do and then begin to teach what to do. And so I founded True Sports Physical Therapy in 2014. In downtown Baltimore, and my passion was treating athletes one-on-one while being in network with insurance, and that's really rung true all the way up until now. So fast forward to now, we have 13 locations, we have 45 physical therapists. Every single session is one-on-one with a sports physical therapist for 45 minutes that is there to know and love your goals and help you reach them. And that's what I do clinically. That's what I do.
Wow. That's pretty amazing growth. You just like jumped over lots of things that were probably not so easy.
It was very smooth. It was very quick. Just went from 2014 to 2023.
Yeah, 9 years later.
Yeah.
You have 45 people working with you. So the thing that you touched on that's interesting here is first, you know, well, you played sports as a kid. Most Americans do, right? And, you know, we do it at whatever level seems to be either our capability or locally what we learn. But there isn't a lot of science to it. And, you know, some people seem to pop up a little higher, maybe they had a good coach. But underlying a lot of it, right, is this physics matters, right? Understanding the body matters. How does it work? Why do we do something at 25 when we can't do it at 45? And like understanding both physics and biology and lifestyle choices. And so tell a little bit, because, you know, I think, you know, you've brought that perspective, which is this much different understanding of the body, so I can make people better at whatever they want to accomplish.
Yeah. I wish what you said was true, that most of Americans play sport. I don't know that that's true anymore.
Maybe not anymore.
Yeah, and it's really unfortunate. I think you're right. I think 30 years ago, when you were growing up, everyone was playing sport. And you see it in cultures and countries across the world. There are far more athletically engaged or movement-minded societies out there. And America, unfortunately, right now is not at the forefront of that. So I would say that that's one thing, is like, what is our learning and movement age? And whether we're studying it in school or whether we're just learning it on the field, how good are we at knowing how to move, what a healthy movement feels like, what an aberrant movement feels like? I think we got to get better at that.
Yeah.
First of all. So I think that's important to frame. Secondarily, in terms of learning what good movement is, there's so much more information out there now, right?
Mm-hmm.
When we were preparing for this pod, you mentioned the Peter Attias of the world, or the Hubermans of the world, or you even see this beautiful crossover between athletic endeavors or physical endeavors and the business world with guys like Tim Ferriss and stuff like that, where they've become students of human movement. And there is a proliferation of information out there. Now the skill is, how do we discern that which is good information? How do we understand when to apply this given information? And so when you talk about health span or well span and lifespan and all these things, how do we put together a construct and a roadmap for every single layperson that's individualized enough that they understand where they are in this arc of longevity? And how is it that they're maximizing their longevity? Because your longevity, Joe, is very different than mine.
Yep. You know, I think we probably need 5 or 10 hours or maybe a couple of weeks together.
I'll just clear my schedule. No problem. Some
of these concepts. But so a couple of things, like I went through, probably not that dissimilar to you. You know, we worked a lot and we fit things in when we could. And then at one point we realized, yeah, but this is an integrated life. This is not just this one dimension. And another side of what we do is we make an investment. And we work, we save some money, we put it into some kind of investment to get some return on it. And then we take our body and we do exactly the opposite, right? We don't invest in it. We don't move as an investment in longevity, right? And so, and then we find ourselves a little bit later on, possibly not as capable as we want to be. So in terms of this idea of human movement and the benefit and return of that, you know, because you're right. I probably was laughing when you were saying, you know, we were kids, you know, played street hockey, we played football in the backyard, we played baseball. Like, there was never a day we didn't do something, right? Ride our bicycles, run up and down the street. And there are people who, you know, if they have a step counter, some people don't get to 500.
Sure.
Like, it's hard to imagine, right? So how are you thinking as you talk to people about this idea of movement and about that that's an investment in who you are, what you're capable of, and what your life can become?
Yeah. The way we talk about it is, thankfully, in my sports practice, so often our clientele is already committing to some type of movement, to some type of athleticism, right? So that is 90% of the battle. You know, once they're in the gym, okay, how do we then choreograph something that's worthwhile and meaningful so that you're not just spinning your wheels or wasting your time and you're headed towards a given end, a desired end, a mutually agreed upon end? What is your goal? Why are you here to see me? Why are you listening to a given podcast? What are you trying to accomplish? And so once we kind of align with that, then it's saying, okay, you're in the gym for how long? How long can you be there? Okay, what are your goals? Are you looking for endurance? Are you looking for strength? Are you looking for hypertrophy? Are you looking to just overcome this injury? Here's the minimal effective dose that we know we need to do in order to achieve that goal. So it's really via dialogue with the patient to say, what are the goals and how do we work together to form them? Now, it's different than what it used to be when I used to work for other people, when you're not dealing with athletes and it's, how do I convince the person who's taking 500 steps that, hey, that's not enough? That's a very different conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it has some of the same themes, which are, what can you commit to, right?
Right.
What is it that you're willing to take on? And there's no question, it is an investment. It's one of the better ones you can make, but it's an investment. You have to put in work in order to get that which comes out. You know, a wise person always said, life doesn't come in a pill. So right. You're not going to get an immediate return like we do with a pill. You know what I mean, Joe?
Yeah, well, I think I live that every day. I think that the other thing, so when we compare like these life stages, you know, there's a lot of talk about life health span, but there are really life stages where biology and choices and lifestyle work well together and don't work. So when you're 25, you know, you can go out late and you can have a few beers and you can get up and you could probably still run a pretty fast 5K. You know, mm-hmm. when you're 50 years old, you know, your biology is not working in your favor. And do you think much about this idea that it isn't an excuse when we modify what we think is possible? Like, we're not going to be as fast. Like, Michael Phelps is never going to swim as fast as he did when sure. he was winning gold medals. Because I think a lot of this is, you know, we end up pushing too hard against what's possible because we're framing it against a different sort of performance potential. Yeah. Do you guys work on that? And how do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, especially when you're either learning new skills or a new understanding of exercise or jumping back into exercise, right? Like, you take a 10-year break because you spend however long really diving into your profession, forgetting the gym. When you go back, it has to be framed that you're not the same person you were yesterday, let alone a decade ago. And so understanding that and trying to give some context and create new goals to get to. We're not trying to chase the 25-year-old Yoni. We're trying to chase the 41-year-old, you know?
That's right.
And I think that's really important. That's why we try to do it clinically as well. How objective can we get? What is the goal? What is a reasonable goal? Let's reverse engineer it. What are the steps we need to take to get there? And hopefully the clinician or the coach or whoever is guiding this, or by the way, even the athlete, there's so much available information now. What's a given expectation? You know, I just went through my own personal blood panel, and it's like they'll give you these ranges of norms, right? But if you really want to dive in, well, even if I say I'm a 41-year-old guy, even if I look at it and say this is the average 41-year-old, well, where do I want to be? I know I'm not going to be the 25-year-old, but let's look at what, you know, what's an athletic 41-year-old? What's an obese 41-year-old? Whatever it is, and figure out where you fit. And the information's out there. God knows with this AI revolution, you better believe there's so much out there. It's about putting things in context.
Yeah. So this is interesting. So there, on one side, there's data, right? That
yep.
It's hard to get to, as we both know, in healthcare. It's not as actionable as it should be. Like when I was going through probably my most intense training life, I would love to have had more fidelity around things like the hematocrit level that was responding to, you know, the physiological demands I was putting on my body. So the red blood cell count, really, because I was an endurance athlete, mm-hmm. if it goes up, certainly is a good thing to know. So you have data on one side, which is informing, and then you have these practices on the other side. And then what you have is also technique. And in trying to bring all of that together for the whatever outcomes you want or the challenges you want to take on. And so how do you feel about that sort of bringing that together and making it part of, you know, that individual? Because I like the idea that you say you work with each individual person and adjust. Where are we on that journey of having that available and then making it practical for people?
I think we're further along than we were 10 years ago. I think a lot of it has to do with, unfortunately, I'd say the financial or medical model that we're in, right? Because to me, and you heard me mention it like in my quick elevator pitch on myself, which is I am so obsessed with spending one-on-one time with my patient.
Yep.
So that I can understand where they are and what's their movement signature. How skilled are they at movement and what that's going to do. Everything I ask, everything I watch is going to give me answers or is geared towards giving them the best possible tool to use to get the outcome they need. An example would be if I'm working on explosiveness with an athlete.
Mm-hmm.
As I talk to them, the questions I ask, and as I watch them move, I'm thinking in my head, okay, what home routine am I going to create for them? Is it going to be a box jump? Is it going to be a single leg box jump? Is it going to be Olympic lifting? Is it going to be a clean? Is it going to be a snatch? Is it going to be a jerk? There's so many ways, like this massive spectrum to find how to work on explosiveness. You got to figure out where that athlete right in front of you is. And if you're the athlete, figure out where are you and what are you capable of and what's the best bang for your buck to keep you healthy. Joe, you made a great point, which is we get hurt more than we should as a population. And I think that's, you know, that's great job security for schmucks like me. But but the only reason that happens is because we push too hard. We don't understand the choices we're making. And maybe we don't have as many tools to use to get the desired outcome. I think that's where finding a great coach or sports PT comes into play. But that's how I address those things. You know, that's how we try to figure out where that athlete is.
I like it. I, you know, part of what excites me about the kind of work that you do and your team does is not only just the individual level, but it's, you know, geared towards the path. You know, they always say that like greatness is a really slow slope. It's not a steep slope. There might be steep, like little pieces in between, which could be like a burst, but it's not steep because you need foundation, right? You have to create foundation to put strain on. It's just very simple concepts that we don't really connect with. And so you're working on that. So,
well, I think we get impatient, right? You just run out of patience.
And so how do you then build that foundation for people? What are pieces of advice that you give and guide people towards?
A couple different tactics, I'd say. One would be if they're coming in post-injury, it's you understand how much time we just lost in terms of getting to your goal because of a given decision that was made or maybe something that was out of our control, but bringing that to the forefront to say, we want to avoid that at all costs, right? Because we just lost all that time. So patience is a virtue. The other side is, and we do this a ton on the sports performance side, when we're just training healthy athletes, is the athlete may or may not know where they are in this massive progression of building foundation and then sprinkling on max efforts and things like that. What they do know is, are they being challenged in the here and now? And so when you're building this massive foundation of, let's say, endurance, if you're an ultra guy, right? Mm-hmm. You better believe you're feeling challenged that entire time through. And so if you look at it from race day, looking back at your training, you're like, duh, I spent 6 weeks working on this massive foundation so I could be ready for something like this. Well, the job of the athlete, the job of the coach is to say in the here and now, in the present, it's not going to feel drawn out because I'm going to meet you where you are and challenge the hell out of you today. And that's why when we teach, to go back to that explosiveness example, yes, we might be working on a small little box jump, but I'm going to make it hard as hell for you so that you're learning a new skill. And so you're far more engaged in the challenge than you are in the fact that, Jesus, 6 weeks away from reaching my max.
Yeah. Do you find, I'm a bit of a setup question, but if you tell someone to do something, you have a higher probability of them doing it than them trying to create that pattern themselves?
Do I find that?
Yeah. We'll listen to the coach. Mm-hmm. The coach's plan will feel more committed, but the plan I write down on a piece of paper, you know, rarely survives.
Yep. There's no question. I mean, I think, especially if you find a coach, you find a sports PT that has some street cred, like you're going to do whatever the hell they say. I mean, like we were talking about Peter Attia, like how do you get better trained than a guy like Peter Attia? And how do you have more, he's just created so much content, right? So he has such street cred that you'd rather listen to him, even though you could probably plan something similar yourself because there's so much information. But yeah, you better believe that you're going to hear it from him. And that's some of the advice that I would speak to as we bring on younger sports PTs like into our clinical fold, it's making sure that while as they relay information, it's not about how long necessarily you've been doing it, but it's about how well you can command and relay that information, because that creates buy-in. That's going to increase compliance. That's going to increase goal attainment, success.
Mm.
And that's how you win.
Yeah, for sure. I think one of the things that's happened in at least in the past 10 or 15 years, as we think about, you know, exercise and more integrated into our lives, is a better understanding of how much time we need to be under very maximum strain versus, we'll call it general strain, you know, like in the running, we'd call it zone two versus zone mm-hmm. four. You know, it might be max power lift versus just lots of repetition. And we're learning more about that. The body doesn't need like this type A thing, like it's always got to be the hardest thing ever, and that's the only thing I get satisfied. But that is, you know, we all do a little bit of coaching on the side, and I have, you know, type A people who never really understand. Like Mark Allen, who was one of the best Ironman athletes, always said, run slow to get fast. And putting in the time to build those, but it doesn't, you don't feel anything as much when it's going on. When you're running a 10-minute mile, you're like, nothing's happening, but stuff is.
Yeah, yeah.
What are your thoughts, you know, as you're helping people understand this difference between, you know, this high intensity and, you know, general activity?
Yeah. Well, like you said, we're learning more. So you're better able to point to examples and proof cases to support your theory, right?
Yeah.
I had a great example of this with a really hard charging linebacker. I mean, super type A, exceptionally intelligent. Every single session, he wanted to be a max session. And he went down to train for the combine, not with us. And they said, okay, but you're going to do a taper week. And he's like, what? They're like, yeah, we're not going to run 40s every single day in prep for your 40. And that was so hard for him to wrap his head around.
Yep.
But he had his best 40 time on combine day, which is exactly what you want. And so it resonated. So it's like creating examples like that, showing them, proving it to them, and then sometimes forcing them to comply. They should see, as complex as we are, our performance is becoming more and more predictable just as a species. Like we're so much better at it. It's crazy. It's amazing. What resonated or what jumped out of my head while you were talking was, I think our newer found obsession with sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And like, it's a great example of, you know, stop saying you can sleep when you're dead, because you're going to miss out on so many things today. Like you're because you're exhausted and you're not going to be performing. You're not going to be mentally there. It's like the type A's have become type A about shutting it down. And it's so important.
Yeah. And well, you know, because there's some of this that's sort of very understandable. And then it's almost you have to deconstruct to reconstruct, right? Because it back to when you're 25 and the mitochondria are producing at this accelerating rate and testosterone, right, is raging. And it's all because biology wants us to create more people. And so it sets us up for that. And then once we're done with that, then the biology doesn't need to accelerate at that rate and it starts to slow. And so it sort of makes sense, but we didn't grow with that. So now we have to adapt to a new way. Yeah. And so I often think that, you know, the hardest thing to learn later on is that, you know, a 9-minute mile is better than no mile, right? Like that's what your choice ends up being. Like you want to run a 7-minute mile, but it's okay. It's better than not sitting on the couch. So, but the other thing I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, I was listening to some of your podcasts and you talk about mechanics and you said you were fascinated with physics, and there are a lot of mechanics in the body that make us both healthier, more capable of taking on what load we want to put on it, and then in repair, getting us back mechanically. So tell us your thinking on this topic.
Okay. My thinking on biomechanics as a whole, I'm still fascinated by it. You know, it doesn't matter what you believe in, what, you know, who you think created this entire system. This system is incredible. It's incredible. And just the fact that, you know, I'm a baseball guy. I'm mesmerized by the human shoulder. The fact that that thing ever works, that your humerus sits inside of your glenoid, which is the socket, and that it rarely falls out. It's not held in by almost anything. And beginning to frame that for athletes in front of you, especially guys that use their shoulders to earn a living, can be a very powerful technique and tool, but it's what gets me out of bed in the morning so often. It's really amazing. So overarchingly, to use one word, I would say enthralled. I'm enthralled by human biomechanics.
Yep.
More specifically, especially with, I think, probably a lot of the population that listens to your pod, understanding biomechanically ways in which we, I hate to use the word degrade, but stop excelling as we age.
Yep.
And trying to fill in those gaps is a way to decrease injury rates, increase how rapidly we can get over them. One thing that sticks out of my mind is the elasticity of our tendons. And so because of everything you mentioned, because of the hormone levels, because of the mitochondrial density, because of just simply the softness and suppleness of the tissue when we're younger, we're able to withstand far more load and we are more resilient. Now, how do we train to decrease the downgrading of those things? And so there are plenty of ways to do it. And so are you training the elasticity of your muscles? Are you training its ability to withstand force and recreate force? I mean, I'm thinking about Achilles tendons, and it's like I'm so bashful about getting back into pickup basketball because I'm just waiting for my Achilles to explode because I'm the age. But the training around that, and can we get the elasticity and the resiliency of that Achilles tendon to keep up with the load we're placing in it? And that's just a matter of adding in 1-2 exercises to already your training regimen. It's a must. It's a must for your population that's thinking, either I want to get off the couch and back to my 5K, or I want to keep doing my ultras. That those tendons need to remain springy and responsive. And we know how to do it. There's simple training protocols to do those things. So I'm super passionate about educating that. I think that answers my outlook on biomechanics from two perspectives.
Yeah, it does. How, you know, we're, I think your point before, which is, you know, we're not getting off the couch enough at a young age, probably not as much later. You know, maybe we have this blip, right? We were doing a lot when we were in our 20s, hit our 40s, like, oh, I should do something. And then we let it go away again. And then hard to bring it back. Now, we could talk probably pickleball for a while and see
what's
happening there. But, you know, this consistency through life, right, is important.
And I think, Joe, you said it, and I love the way you said it, which was, We tend to bucket things. Like, I'll spend my 20s running marathons and I'll spend my 30s diving into my career, and then I'll dust it back off in my 40s because I want to get rid of this gut. And we lose this blend, right? We lose the ability to blend and stay consistent. And I think that's where real health is won and earned, is in that consistency. And that's what I think leads to the injury rates, right? When you forget to blend or you stop blending, and how important that is. It's also, we were talking a little bit business before. I think it's the same thing with this work-life balance that people preach about, right? Like, in my world, I don't clock out, right? I find myself not being a factory worker where I punch in and out, and now I think about work, and now I don't think about work, and now I think about family, and now I don't think about family. If you can find that which it is you love, it becomes like this beautiful continuum of work life, as opposed to an overbearing work bleeding into my life. If you could figure out how to love both and integrate both, it's the same thing with exercise, right?
I totally agree with that. I like to think of like work life harmony.
Ooh, it's good.
You know, that harmonize them. And you know, challenge is challenge. I don't know if I'm getting paid to do it or I'm choosing to do it in the gym. I should just find that the integrity that I bring to it, meaning that I want to perform whatever my task is. Like if you said, hey, Joe, you should, you know, be a garbage collector, then I should just do that great too. Like, why Why have, you know, the sort of fantasy of loving what you do? Why don't you just doing what you love? Why don't you just love what you do all the time? And I think that this is the other part of this physical part of our lives, is understanding that there's a massive return on the investment of time you put into that, you know. Mm-hmm. And I do think the probably, you know, the fanboys around Peter Attia, but the thing that I like his focus is, when you're 80, you should be able to do activities that you would want to be able to do. Hang out with your grandkids, go to the grocery store, walk up the stairs, you know, feel still vibrant, right? The blue zones that are being researched more and more, you know, trying to, when you have work-life harmony, don't carry stress as deeply, you know? And so, but these are, I think, part of what's great about the scope of now your practices is touching more people with these messages. And so when you're looking for people to join, how is it to find people who share your vision and passion for, you know, well, PT is PT, except, right? Like,
Yeah, I think it's so different now. And I think I was naive to think it would be the same. And here's what I mean. When I started hiring people in 2000, probably 14 or 15, it was probably 14. That wasn't by design. I didn't think about how am I going to hire? What am I going to hire? What am I looking for? I wasn't that thoughtful. But what I did know, that whatever got me to the point of needing to hire someone, was grit and work ethic, and no one's going to outwork me. I'm going to sleep in that clinic, and I'm going to be there for the 6 a.m. patient, and I'm going to see a 10 p.m. patient, and I'm going to sleep on the treatment table. And that's what success is. And that those are things that I looked for in my first few hires. That does not work 10 years later. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't work because it's not sustainable. That is not a way to scale. And I think one of the mistakes I made was trying to just keep looking for the same thing. Whereas now what we're able to do is look for therapists and team members and coaches that are passionate about what they do and what we do. They want to grow. They want to learn. And part of growth and part of learning is understanding when to throttle up and when to pull back, so that these things can be sustainable. And that's the way you grow. That's the way you grow when you're trying to hypertrophy a muscle. That's the way you grow when you're building a business. And that's, wrapping my head around that idea was a total mindset switch or change that I kind of came to gradually. And 10 years from now, if I'm still hiring, it's going to look different. That's what I fanboy about Peter Attia about, because that guy would not shut up about intermittent fasting. And then all of a sudden he's like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
This might not be the panacea I thought it was.
Yeah.
And he was able to change. And I think that adaptability is something, God knows I try to work on that every day. I think it's what we can all work on, is just realizing that this entire thing is a process, whatever it is you're trying to grow.
Totally agree with you. I write about the journey every day. So a little bit of a shift, because this is a really big, important topic for us in our health system in the country. $4.2 trillion spent. We mostly work on sick care. We really don't work on health care. But, you know, we have to figure out how to align sort of more of the choices that we make and find a way to pay for it, so that people.
Joe, before you ask me this question, ready? I don't know what you're going to ask me, but let's say I take a country of 300 million people,
mm-hmm.
and I say, Joe, I want you to do this right. I want you to set up this healthcare model right. What does that look like?
Yeah, I think that the same thing that we would do for any other productive business or process that we live in our lives generally, which is setting a foundation for, you know, both the principles and outcomes we want to achieve. You know, what are the processes? What's the data that we need? How do we support and, you know, direct that to this outcome, right? Outcome for us isn't defined in healthcare. Outcome is misguided. So that's what we would have to do, and start at an early age with a system that builds that foundation.
Okay. So what are you trying to achieve, and what's your system, Joe?
Me personally, or
yeah, if you're designing it for the country, right?
Yeah, I think that what is, if we really thought about, you know, because listen, to your point, Yoni, we've changed a lot in the past 100 years. We were farmers, 98% of us in 1890, and now there's 2% of us are farmers. In a very short period of time, we've radically changed how we live, mm-hmm. and, you know, whether it's the resources we have, you know, to the way we eat, to the way we socialize. So everything has radically shifted, and we have not evolved sort of how we've lived to be productive anything past sort of the average old sort of midpoint of life, right? So the midpoint of life used to be 30, and the midpoint of life is closer to 45, you know, and so, but we have no systems that accommodate for that. So we have to actually mm-hmm. rethink, if we're going to live for this long period of time, how should we build a foundation that allows us to be productive members of society at a lower cost because we made good decisions early on? You know,
yeah.
we didn't have education 100 years ago in the way that we did. You know, I think it was in like 1915, only 10% of Americans even went out to high school. And so all these foundation concepts we need to bring in with health at an early age mm-hmm. that would then connect to this outcome of living to 100 years. And how would you need to do that?
Yeah. We're also, if we're going to do that, we need to decrease the debt of the providers, right? Think about that. I look at this all the time because Israel has a very heavily socialized medical program or system. And I'm always looking at like, I want to spend more time in Israel. But if I have hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt, how do I go to Israel and provide care for pennies on the dollar? I'll never pay it off. And if all these people aren't sick in America, let's say we're just staying in America, if all these people aren't sick, they're not paying a bunch of money
right.
to go see their doctor. Their doctor has to earn a certain amount of money because he owes a certain amount of money.
That's right. Yeah. So $4.2 trillion can pay for good health care.
Yeah.
It can. There's no question about that. And a plan of $7 trillion in the 2032 timeframe will crush the U.S. economy. So I think what we're like every other system that got better, what we have to do is optimize for, you know, change. And there are some people who aren't going to like the change. There's health plans that make a lot of money administering a payment system that aren't adding any value. Imagine if you or I like set out on this goal, which is sort of this project I'm working on informally, which is to say that over the next 20 years, next 30 years, 40 years, our goal is, other than in tragic sort of circumstances, we're going to consume almost no healthcare costs. And if, what if 10 million people did that? Not out of 340 million, like only 10, we would probably save $100 billion because we wouldn't have consumed that $500,000 in the last 6 months of our life. And just that, forget the rest.
Yep.
So there are ways that we can actually individually put less strain on the healthcare system that'll free up some money that should go back into when you as a provider compensating you properly so you can put systems in place that would allow all of us to have access to your service that would make us all healthier. The irony, right, is that we have yet to realize that healthcare is just like education. It's got to start early. It's got to build a foundation. And it's how you actually create more productive humans. And I think in the next 10 years, we'll start to entertain this because the momentum is building. We just have to figure out how to work around this system. You know, this is like sort of my passion. It's funny that you asked that because this is my passion, is to try and figure out how we leverage the dollars we have available, mm-hmm. not to just deal with the problem, but deal with mm-hmm. the solution.
Yeah. Isn't it ironic that you compare the healthcare system to the educational system, yet within the educational system, they're cutting back on our healthy habits?
Oh, amen. So that system also is in a struggle, you know?
Yeah.
But what's not a struggle is our social media systems, you know, which are triggering our dopamine system and playing into the sort of only like sort of a manipulation. So we're smart enough people to figure stuff out. But what hasn't happened, I think, and maybe, you know, in your practice, the people who come in, if you were to ask them a sort of a simple question, which is like, you know, what outcome do you want? You're like, what do you want to have happen in the next 20 years? How many people are suited to answer those questions or come in knowing what they want to do?
I think it is, if you look at a general population, what we call Gen Pop in PT, I think it is few and far between. As you start whittling down, you know, our sample size is so skewed, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Fortunately and unfortunately, right? It's like by design. We have a really motivated population. So a lot of them know why they're there and what they want out of it. As a provider, that's a freaking dream. It's a dream.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think we're blessed. And I think if I told you I had a tremendous amount or overwhelming majority of my patients came in not really knowing what they wanted out of the session, I'd be lying to you. Yeah. But it took time to get there. And it's not the, you know, I'm kind of torn about it because it's not the most altruistic thing. I worked in Gen Pop. I just wanted to blow my head off because I had a population that didn't want to do the work or didn't even know what they were doing there. They were there because their lawyer told them to come, or they were there because they didn't want to go to work, or they were there because their back hurt. But when I start talking about some form of exercise, well, I'm not going to do exercise to help my back. Well, that becomes really burdensome. And so I kind of feel bad saying that, but it's a very privileged life that we lead at True Sports that we have an engaged population.
But it is a signal through the noise that we can get to a good place because not every one of those people started there.
And some You're of absolutely them
probably right. came yeah. from something else. We need to have this sort of, and you know, they say hope is not a strategy, right? But hopefulness is a good attribute to have in one's life, yep. which is that we can get better and we can get there. And I don't, you know, 20% of the American population is on Medicaid, which means they are financially struggling enough that they can't pay for any healthcare any way possible. But these are still resilient, smart people who want a better life.
You're right. And I think so much of it is how do we get the proper education to these people? What would be awesome is if their primary care physician who's taking their Medicaid is being paid by the government to provide care to this patient didn't say, here is your prescription to fix your problem. They said, here, there's this thing called exercise. And you know, I say it with a little bit of sarcasm, but how powerful would that be? And what percentage of our primary care physicians understand what zone 2 cardio is? What? How many? How many understand what, okay, your BMI is X. How do you change that? Not what's bad and what's good. Mm-hmm. How do you go from bad to good? The answers are really simple.
Yeah.
They just have to be provided and they don't come in a press and twist bottle always.
No. And there are some times where that's necessary. But what we know is that we need to just change the percentages here, right? So
yeah.
Today it's 10% who are finding the methods that create good health and 90% are doing these other things. And if we could just shift it to 50-50, we would have massive improvement. We're not trying to get everyone running an ultra marathon. I knew this myself, and I'm not trying to campaign for anyone to live my lifestyle.
Yep.
What I think we both would agree is that if you go back to what is that, back to what outcome do you want? Do you want to have, you know, this healthy vital life that makes you feel good, you know, and you can do the things you want to do for a long period of time, then that outcome can get connected with choices that will help make that happen more likely. Yeah. We have to move the system in that direction.
Yeah. What do you think of that? Is that idea of the primary care physician, who else needs to be on that list of people that understand basic exercise? I think it's them and I think it's kindergarten teachers. Who else you got?
Yeah, I think that actually, I was thinking about like, where do we spend most of our time? And I think that employers need to play a role in encouraging through whatever techniques, either through benefits that they could give us, you know, in the company that I get the chance to run, you know, we have a health and wellness benefit that people can spend up to $1,000 on a gym membership, sneakers, going to whatever. So they have some facility and capability to do more. So I think employers can play a role, because a healthier employee is better for me. Yep. And so I don't think that it can just be that. And then I think, you know, I always think about, like, where are groups that are established that we need to leverage their benefit? And so employers are a big part of our lives, of course. Educational systems. I think we used to have a lot of stuff like that. We don't anymore.
Yep.
We need to reintroduce it. So let's go back to existing systems with some good concepts to share and own the responsibility of making it a healthier community for all.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right. I think that's powerful stuff.
So, you know, we could talk forever, and I appreciate what you're doing. I think, you know, maybe that I always like to close, you know, when I created the name of this podcast as Chasing Tomorrow, because I always told people, let's chase tomorrow together, you know, which means, like, how am I going to lean into the future? So if you thought about your Chasing Tomorrow, Yoni, what's the sort of the future look for you like?
I'm really investing in and putting a lot of my brain power in building leaders in the sports rehab space, right? Mm. And that's also, it's been a mindset shift in that, how do I create paths for my teammates to excel and grow in whatever arena they want that to be in? Hopefully it's with us, but it doesn't have to be with athlete care. Mm. Maybe it's with education, right? Maybe it's with management of other PTs. Maybe it is in treating higher level athletes and things of that nature, and creating that sense of success in an individualized way.
Yeah.
Because they're so unique. So I think that's, in some capacity, what the next few years will look like for me, professionally speaking.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, you know, we're all benefiting from, you know, idealists and entrepreneurs like you who are out there doing something. The growth that you've had is not just demonstrative that you can grow a good business, but that there is a real need that is being met and you're meeting it. We need to do it more at scale. You know, 4,500 endpoints would be great for you to have one day. And
I'm good with that.
And let's go on this journey together. You know, the more the message gets consistent and we understand the benefits we get, the better for all. So Yoni, thanks for doing what you're doing, and thanks for coming on the podcast.
This is a great time. Thanks for doing what you're doing. I've really enjoyed myself. I appreciate you, Joe.
Thank you.